Welcome to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by ancient language and biblical scholar Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity: Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevahscrossing.com. Lecture 10, The Resurrection of Jesus.
When we study the New Testament, in particular the Gospels, we must give attention to the problems raised by the presence of miracles in these narratives. I want to take four lectures to deal with what is rather a difficult and complex problem, essentially a philosophical problem, the question of miracles.
The importance of the resurrection question.
Now, in this morning's lecture, we want to ask, is there good evidence for a particular miracle? Namely, is there good evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Another way of putting it is this: what are the reasons for thinking the resurrection may actually have happened? Now, you may think miracles can happen, but doubt that a particular alleged miracle, such as the resurrection, really did happen. So the resurrection of Jesus is one question. But there's also the larger question: can miracles happen at all? And of course, if you think you've answered that question with, no, they can't, then there isn't any point in talking about any specific alleged miracle, because, according to your supposition, it didn't happen. Nonetheless, in the next lecture, we will delve into the more general question, can miracles happen at all? Now, this may be coming at what seems backwards to you, that I'm talking first of all about a specific alleged miracle, the resurrection of Christ, and then about the more philosophical question, can miracles happen? It is important for us to deal with this question partly because it is not an easy thing to believe that a man can come to life again, having been dead for a few days. As far as you know personally, this has never, ever happened. You do know of stories of this sort, presumably all of them in the Bible, but your own personal experience includes no such incidences. Moreover, there are many current reasons for calling in question the resurrection of Christ. The book, The Passover Plot, New Light on the History of Jesus, by Hugh Schoenfield, who lived from 1901 to 1988, is the most recent of a long, long series of efforts to do this. Schoenfield, whose book is now in paperback and was incidentally on the bestseller list for several weeks, thinks that Jesus was an ordinary person, at least in terms of being supernatural. He was ordinary. And that he wanted to get himself recognized as the Messiah by people. And so he staged or got himself executed by the Jewish religious leaders, only not quite. This was the plan. He wasn't going to be quite dead, and his followers were going to get him down, and he was going to stage a resurrection, and everyone would believe he was the Messiah. Only things went wrong, says Schoenfield, and they didn't get him down fast enough. This is one of the long series of efforts to dispose of the New Testament stories about the resurrection. A much more sophisticated effort was promulgated by German New Testament scholar Rudolf Bultmann. Bultmann says, all of these stories in the New Testament do not look like historical accounts to me. They look more like myths and legends. And since they are myths, they are trying to tell us something true. But of course, what they tell us truly is not that a man can come back from the dead, but something, which we can't be sure of, extraordinary happened to make those disciples think the way they thought. Besides all this, there is a broad notion or a pronounced bias in our society and in Western society generally, against the supernatural and in favor of naturalism. I've already alluded to this a time or two in opening up the course material for you. This turns up in many ways. A cartoon in the Society Review shows two fish in a goldfish bowl. They are talking to each other. The one fish says to the other, "All right, if there isn't any God, who changes the water every week?" You get a few very sinister cartoons because they imply that what we attribute to God is really only the working of natural agency, which we do not yet understand very well. This is part of the general anti-supernatural bias, which our day is part of. And for reasons such as this, it seems to be important that we talk about the resurrection of Christ. All of this has everything to do with the fact that somehow, at the center of the Christian faith, there is the person of Christ. And the single most important thing about him would be his death and resurrection. Now, we've been talking about the character of the Gospels as from the historical record, and more can be said about this presently. But I am assuming, in spite of certain problems which I admit remain, that the Gospels are a reasonably trustworthy report of things which happened in Roman Palestine around 30 AD. There are three ways of coming at this: logically, eyewitnesses, and transformed lives. I'd like to go over each of these. There will be in this material not much that will be new if you've already read the assigned material for the day, although it may be that I can pull this together in a way that will be helpful.
1. Logical evidence.
How do we know that such an unlikely thing as the resurrection of a man from the dead actually happened? There is, first of all, the fact that Jesus' tomb was empty.
Jewish authorities said the tomb was empty.
Now, we assume that it was empty because, among other things, the Jewish authorities at the time admitted that it was empty. They, of course, had a story of their own to account for it. They said at the time that Jesus' disciples had stolen the body while the guards slept, although it's not a very popular story for guards to keep in circulation. But according to Matthew, they were told to put this story into circulation and promised that if they were ever charged with dereliction of duty, that the higher-ups would cover for them.
The empty tomb was available for inspection.
But there are other considerations than this to suggest the tomb was empty. And the major one is that for about 2 years, Jesus' followers stayed right in the city of Jerusalem, conducting preaching and teaching, the content of which had at its core the affirmation that their leader had risen from the dead. If they had been 1,000 miles away, it would have been different. But they were in the city where the execution had taken place and where the tomb was located. They were saying these things in a context where any local with the energy to do so could take a 5-minute walk and see if the tomb was empty or not. It's impossible for us to think that the disciples could have gotten away with that kind of preaching that the book of Acts shows they did, if Jesus' body was still right there in the tomb and anybody could verify that fact. Nobody denied that the tomb was empty. Hugh Schofield does not. Those persons who disbelieve the resurrection most strongly do not deny that the tomb was empty.
Why was the tomb empty?
So we will begin with this. And the procedure is to see how the empty tomb can be accounted for. The New Testament, of course, accounts for it by the explanation that Christ had been raised from the dead by the power of God. If you do not like this explanation, then you must propose another one, which accounts equally well, or one which we can trust better, for the fact that the tomb was empty. And what the Christian apologist says at this point is simply,
"Yes, it is not easy to believe, but the New Testament says is true."
But then, what the New Testament claims is no harder to believe than any of the alternative explanations. The New Testament version of the story of Christ's resurrection has no more difficulties, and perhaps fewer, than the alternative explanations.
So that is what these four subpoints are, just an effort to look quickly at the explanations which have been given for the emptiness of the tomb and to see if they are any better explanations than the one the New Testament gives, or to see if they have fewer difficulties. Now, this is well-known material, easy to come by in your reading, but let me note the high points here.
A. Did the disciples remove the body?
Now, for this to make sense, we would have to agree in advance that the disciples had some reason for getting the body out of the tomb and having it turn up missing. This might be the case if they were expecting the resurrection to occur and they wanted it to look as if Jesus' prophecy had been fulfilled. But it's clear from all the records of the Gospels themselves that the disciples did not understand that Jesus intended to rise from the dead. It's one of these hard things to explain. He told them enough times, they just didn't understand. And even after it happened, they were very hard to be convinced. So they weren't expecting a resurrection. Why then would they want to do anything with the body? And just on ordinary grounds, on ritualistic grounds, as Jews, it was religiously illegal for men to handle a corpse. It may seem strange to you, but Jews had ceremonial regulations that prohibited them from having contact with corpses, except in certain situations. And certainly the robbing of a grave would not be one of those. So it was against their religious law to do so. The great difficulty is, however, that the time came when a great many of the disciples had to lay down their lives for the story that Christ had risen. It becomes very hard for us to think that men, all the time knowing that they had swiped the body, would suffer torture and death for what was really a lie. One of them may have cared enough about their lie to die for it, but certainly there were some faint-hearted souls in that party who, rather than go through with death, would have told the truth and said,
No, we took it out. I'll tell you where we put it.
As far as we can tell, every one of the disciples that was called upon to die a violent death, they did not all, but many of them did, every one of them went through the violent death as a martyr for his story that Christ had risen. John Stott says,
hypocrites and martyrs are not made of the same stuff.
I just think it is very difficult psychologically for us to believe that if they had taken the body, that they would have ended their lives the way they did.
B. Did Roman or Jewish authorities take the body?
We can think of reasons why they might have wished to do so. The Romans may have wished to keep the tomb from being a rallying point for Jewish nationalists. The Jews were never happy with Roman authority, and Jesus had been executed wrongly, of course, but had been executed on the charges of sedition, advocating the overthrow of the government by force and violence. And seeing that this was so, the Roman authorities may have wished to keep his tomb from becoming a pilgrimage site for Jewish patriots. Jewish authorities may have had some analogous reasons. Jesus was, in their judgment, a false Messiah, a maker of trouble in their religious establishment. And now that he had died, it may be that they would have wished his tomb not to become a rallying point for the sectarian elements within the Jewish church. There were such elements. The Dead Sea Scrolls are ample witness to sectarian elements in Judaism, and it is plausible to think that Jewish authorities might have wished to keep the tomb from becoming a pilgrimage site for religious discontent. However, if either of these authorities had taken the body in an effort to keep things quiet and to avoid disturbances, it would have soon become clear to them that they had made a mistake. For the kind of disturbances that resulted in the next 10 to 20 years because of the preaching of the resurrection vastly exceeded any disturbances that might have resulted from patriots or religious malcontents. And it seems likely that if the Romans or the Jews were interested in keeping order once the city and the countryside became aroused over the preaching of the resurrection, all they would have had to do was say, "All right, you guys, we'll tell you the truth. We took the body. Here's why we took it, and here's what we did with it." That would have instantly quelled all of the rabble-rousing, which was kind of an indirect result of the preaching of the resurrection. It was greatly to the advantage of either of these authorities to say so, if they had taken the body. As far as we know, they never said so. We almost have to believe that if they had said so, the Christian movement would have collapsed. The fact that it continued seems to indicate that no voice was ever raised to say that either of these authorities had taken the body.
C. Was Jesus really dead?
It may be argued, and here we touch on Hugh Schofield and many other similar theories, that Jesus was not really dead. That is, in the process of execution, he fainted, lapsed into unconsciousness, and was mistakenly thought dead when he was removed from the cross and placed in the tomb. He regained consciousness in the tomb, and this accounts for the fact that the body was no longer there. Now, there are some pretty bad loopholes in this, according to our best information. For example, Joseph of Arimathea asked that the body be taken down from the cross and be given burial, primarily because, as a devout Jew, Joseph did not want the body exposed on a religious holiday. The request came to Pilate himself, who was surprised that Jesus was dead so soon, and he sent soldiers to guarantee that Jesus was dead before the body was taken down. Now, in Roman executions, you can't have any missteps. A man who is executed has got to be really dead, and so Pilate sent two soldiers to make sure that Jesus was really dead. It doesn't seem likely that a mistake could have been made under these conditions. Pilate had to be sure. His authority was at stake, and presumably, Roman soldiers who frequent the places of execution know how to kill people and know when they are dead or not. But even if we assume, which seems very difficult to assume, that Jesus could have been taken from the cross still alive, it is also very difficult to suppose that there is anything restorative about the atmosphere of the tomb. And having gone through what he suffered, he could have regained enough strength to rouse himself, get up, move the stone, remove the guard, and convince his disciples that he had come back victorious over death. That he wasn't really dead just seems too much to believe. That he rose from the dead is hard, is true. But is believing Jesus survived a crucifixion any easier? There are, well, loopholes in the New Testament story, but are there any fewer here? It seems that there are not.
D. Did the women go to the wrong tomb?
There is a very old story which is occasionally put forth in scholarly dress that the women who first discovered the risen Lord had gone to the wrong tomb. This hardly seems worthy to mention, except it has been put forth in our own century by the eminent Harvard scholar Christopher Lake, who describes the theory in these terms.
"The women came to the tomb. It was early morning, still dark. The mists of the early morning were hovering over the valley of the garden. They were distraught with grief and weeping all night. Here they were, tears in their eyes, frantic, half-hysterical women, groping their way to the site of the tomb in the early morning mist, and somehow they missed the right tomb and get to the wrong one."
Now, the theory requires that the gardener be at the tomb at that early hour. It's a little hard to explain, but he was there before dawn, and he saw that the women were going to the wrong tomb. He recognized them. He knew what they were there for. He knew where the body really was. He saw them hovering around an open tomb where Jesus hadn't even been buried. And he went over and tried to straighten things out, and he said something like this,
"Women, he is not here. Behold the place where they laid him."
And then pointed to the real tomb. See, somehow the women got it all mixed up. They thought the gardener was an angel and that he was announcing, "He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him." And they assumed he had risen from the dead, and they rushed off to tell this story. You can only accept this by making a number of very difficult assumptions. For one thing, the Gospels don't say it was dark. They say it was the time of breaking dawn. There is the problem of why the gardener is there at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning. But there's the additional problem that the women went back, told Jesus' male disciples who investigated, presumably Peter and John knew where the tomb really was. Presumably grown men don't cry. Presumably they would not have made the same mistake. That's what the theory requires, that in broad daylight, Jesus' disciples visiting the tomb made the same mistake that the historical women made in the early morning mist. Besides all this, if this is the correct explanation, then the body was in the tomb after all, and we're back to the first point. So this is the only theory that suggests that the tomb was not empty, and it flounders on the same difficulty which led us to assume, at the beginning, that the tomb was empty. It has got so many difficulties. Well, now, this is part of the argument, you see. Nobody supposes that it is a simple, easy thing to believe that the New Testament theory is true. But when you look at the alternatives, they are at least as hard to believe. And some of them would strain our credulity even more. So here is a kind of argument from probability, historical probability. Our best reconstruction of things indicates that it is as probable or more probable that the New Testament story, which rests on eyewitnesses, is truer than any of these ad hoc hypotheses are true.
2. Eyewitnesses.
This brings us to a second major point. There were witnesses. Now, it does not seem that any witnesses of the actual emergence from the tomb have come forth. What happened to the guards when this took place? Who can know? We only know the story they were told to tell. We do not know what they actually said. But if there was no one to witness the actual emergence from the tomb, there were persons who saw him apparently alive after it was clear he had been killed. He was seen by witnesses. After his death, there are records that 10 persons or groups of persons saw him. Now, what would you do with these testimonies? They're very hard to accept. You don't see people alive after they've died. Here are 10 persons or groups of persons who saw that after the well-known and carefully planned execution of Jesus, they saw him alive. Paul's list in 1 Corinthians 15 is very, very impressive. He writes,
"He, Jesus, appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive, although some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me."
Paul is writing within 25 years of the resurrection. 1 Corinthians was written in the early 50s. And in the 15th chapter, 3rd verse, Paul just says, in essence, "Now I haven't made these things up which I have told you. I have passed on to you what was delivered to me." Incidentally, that is a very technical linguistic form that rabbis used with their students. The rabbis, with their great concern to put things just as their teachers said it, are always saying, "Rabbi so-and-so delivered such-and-such to his students." And here is Paul using the same form. "I received what was delivered to me." One of the things that Paul says, which was an essential part of his earliest instruction as a Christian, was that Christ died and was raised from the dead. And he mentions in that passage several persons who were witnesses to Christ's living person, including a group of 500 people who saw him at the same time. Paul gives names here, Peter and James. He does everything but give addresses and phone numbers. And when Paul says this, and is specific within 20 to 25 years of the event, it seems clear that what he was really saying was, if you don't believe this story, here are the people that saw it. Go and ask them for yourself. The Gospels also contain reports of persons who saw Jesus after his resurrection, including twice to a group of disciples, as well as individual appearances. And then there are the appearances of Christ to the women. Now, really, something must be done with these statements of eyewitnesses. We've either got to assume that they were invented wholesale, which just can't stand up under the kind of controls that existed at the time the stories were put into circulation and written, or you must give some kind of credence to the testimony of these persons. Now, there are those who say, drawing on conclusions of modern psychology, that these appearances were hallucinations. We know what a hallucination is. Such things do occur. It is a vision in which the person sees or thinks he sees an apparition of some sort, a scene, a person. We understand something about hallucinations and the conditions under which they occur. Stott has touched on this, and he does so very carefully and wisely, I think. Hallucinations occur under situations where an eager expectation is present. But it's clear that among the people that survived Jesus, there was no eager expectation that he would reappear. In fact, when Jesus himself encountered two of these persons on the road to Emmaus, in the 24th chapter of Luke, one is unnamed, one is an otherwise unknown disciple named Cleopas. When he encountered these two men, they did not recognize him. He drew them into conversation, and they were ready enough to tell him about their discouragement as the result of the execution of their leader. And they said, "We had hoped." They were living in the pew-perfect tense. There was nothing of present expectation about it. It was all over. Seeing that the whole idea of expectation of Christ's resurrection was not present, how could these have been a hallucination? Moreover, it seems unlikely that to all of these different persons, including a large number at the same time, essentially the same apparition would occur. What we know from the study of persons who see visions of this sort is that a man's hallucination is uniquely his own, and it is very hard to understand how essentially the same figure could have been reconstructed just from hallucination. But I am really very impressed with the testimony of these witnesses. I admit they testify to something happening that doesn't ordinarily happen. But then we live in a world where there is mystery. And unless we have decided that we know all there is to know about the world, we can't be sure what can and cannot happen. But more on that later.
3. Disciples' Transformation.
Finally, there is also a certain change in the complete outlook and orientation of the disciples. I've already alluded to their discouragement and depression after Jesus' death. We know something about the posture which Jesus' disciples adopted at the time of his arrest and execution. Peter, for example, just a few hours earlier, had been bold in his affirmation of loyalty to Jesus. But when Peter was on the spot during Jesus' trial, Peter did in fact deny that he ever knew Christ. There is something about this which is very craven and cowardly. When we see Peter next, or at least when we see him in the book of Acts, he is not a cowardly person at all. He is the spokesman for the young church. And on the day of Pentecost, in the second chapter of Acts, when the crowd is murmuring ugly things like,
"These guys are drunk, they are carrying on so,"
it is Peter who stands up and says,
"Now listen to me. These people are not drunk. Here is why they are not, and here is what is going on."
He not only stands up to them, he tells them very plainly that they are guilty for the death of the Messiah, which can hardly have been a pleasant sentiment to hear uttered on that occasion. The people who had executed him were in the audience, no doubt. Now, something happened to change Peter from a craven, frightened individual to a person who could stand up in front of a menacing crowd and hold his own the way he did. The same thing may be said about James, Jesus' cousin, who did not believe in Jesus during his lifetime. James was one of the persons to whom Jesus appeared individually after the resurrection, and this seems to have persuaded James that his cousin truly was the Messiah. And although he is not as well known in the early church as Peter, it is clear from certain references that James had a great deal of influence, particularly in Palestine, as a leader of the church. What happened? Was James just smitten with guilt and emotion from the unkind way he treated his cousin, and this led him to these conclusions? Also, I've already spoken of the conversion of Paul. Paul was not exactly an eyewitness to the risen Christ in the same sense. But the same sort of change took place in Paul. Now, psychologically, class, this kind of biometric and dramatic change in a person's outlook cannot be accounted for except by assuming some tremendous intervention. It does seem that being convinced that Jesus had come back from the dead would do it. It does not seem that having made up the story that he came back from the dead would be adequate to carry this through. This argument of making up stories for the resurrection is often stated in terms of the entire existence of the church. Yet, for this change in the disciples, how could the church have stayed in existence? How could the people who were part of it in its earliest months and years have sustained themselves if the resurrection of Christ were not true? Now, those are the three lines of evidence supporting the resurrection of Christ. One is a strictly logical argument. I mean logical in the sense that it deals with arguments of proof. That is, the argument that the resurrection is more probable than any alternate theory. The second is an appeal to eyewitnesses whose reports have come down to us, reports which it seems you must take seriously. And the third is a kind of deductive argument from the change that occurred in the lives of the disciples.
Not proofs, but a strong probability.
I do not think these arguments prove the resurrection. They do establish, it seems to me, a probability, a strong probability, and in historical study, this is all we need to ask for. It is not given to us, in study of the past, to have a proof that anything happened. We do establish a very strong probability that things in the past happened, but because we were not there, we are always dependent, ultimately, on the testimony of the people who were. And so you and I cannot have proved George Washington existed, whose birthday we just observed. In fact, that we observed his birthday certainly doesn't prove he existed, nor does the fact that a great many people believe he existed prove it. Had we been there, at the crossing of the Delaware, we would have had some direct basis for our conclusions. But we are dependent on the testimonies of persons who were there. Even Washington's own record might be forged. We think they are not because the evidence from that time is very full and rich. But at best, we establish a probability. And when you begin working with the records of the past, there have been frequent frauds in which people have maintained for a long time that certain things were so that were not. I'm just saying that in historical study, probability is the best we ever get. And that is what we have here. These are therefore not proofs, but arguments which establish a balance of probability. Now, among conservative Christians, the proofs for the resurrection of Jesus Christ have often had a great deal of importance. I do not know if you have ever been presented with this material before or not. I think on the whole, young people coming up in our churches are not presented with this kind of case for the trustworthiness of the resurrection of Christ. And as arguments, as evidence, I think this is very important for us to understand. Few people who deny the resurrection have ever heard this way of looking at it. I think you ought to know how to look at the resurrection of Christ in this way, and I think you ought to know it rather well. When it comes to what you ought to know, I can't insist that you believe in the arguments. I do think you ought to be able to handle them with some degree of skill.
Theology of the Resurrection.
But it is not, recall, the arguments for the historicity of the resurrection which are the most important thing, it seems to me. I think of equal importance is the theological significance of the resurrection of Christ to Christian people. I want to mention here two things in drawing this lecture to a close.
The resurrection demonstrates Jesus was God.
First of all, the resurrection is the great demonstration that the claim Jesus made for himself was true, a demonstration of his lordship and messiahship. As Stott discusses in part one of his book, Basic Christianity, Christ's resurrection is one of three aspects of Christ's person that establish his divinity. The other two aspects deal with Christ's claims and his character, which I will talk about later in the course when I talk about Christ's person. See lectures 19 and 26. Paul understood the resurrection this way.
Christ Jesus was declared the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. Romans 1:4.
Paul accepted the resurrection from the dead as a kind of guarantee of Jesus' messiahship. This is to say, a well-established fact of this sort demands some kind of commitment from people who believe it. It is not in the same category of proving that Washington crossed the Delaware. Because if Christ really was God in person, showing himself to people and bringing them to himself, then the man who says, "I believe this," is also obligated in a very special way to begin to act as though that were true. This is why John Bailey, who lived from 1886 to 1960, says,
"Would the people who see you daily and with whom you have the most to do be able to guess, even if you had not told them, that you believe in the divinity of Christ?"
The bodily resurrection gives hope to the Christian.
Second, it also says something which we usually do not grasp about the hope of the believer for the next life. Now, when we say in the Apostles' Creed, if you know the Apostles' Creed,
"I believe in the resurrection of the body,"
we are not talking about Jesus Christ. We are talking about Christian persons who have died or who will die. This concept is developed more fully in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, which I have already referred to in connection with Paul's statement of witnesses. It is there affirmed by Paul that the Christian who dies goes into the next life, not a disembodied spirit, but a whole person, including a body. Now, there are questions we can't answer about this. Some things remain a mystery for us now. But it is clear that the New Testament does not speak of immortality of the soul as though we will spend all eternity floating through space like a wisp of smoke playing on a harp, a disembodied spirit. The resurrection of the body is a guarantee that you'll spend the next life as a whole person, including having a body so you can do things that you are accustomed to do. The next life will be a kind of excitement, of interest, of activity, when I will be a whole person with an inner life and with an outer person to express the inner life. Now, how does the resurrection of Christ suggest this? Because it shows us Jesus after he had died. It shows us him having a body, able to do some things with it that we can't do with ours, like walk on the sea, or suddenly appear and disappear inside rooms. And Christ's body is recognizable by his friends, eating, talking, carrying on, very much like the kind of life we know here. I think this means that we ought to look upon our entry into the next life, whenever it shall come, probably not very soon for most of us, as moving into the most exciting sphere of activity we have ever experienced. In the last poem which he ever wrote, Robert Browning, who lived from 1812 to 1889, speaks of this. He imagines himself, after his death, continuing his life and activity in another world, and he leaves behind to his friends the request that, as he is in the other world, they would cheer him on in the activity that he is undergoing. He says in the concluding stanza of his poem Epilogue,
"No, at noonday in the bustle of man's work time, greet the unseen with a cheer."
He means himself. It means when my birthday comes around, get together and give three cheers for Browning. He's having a good time.
Bid him forward, breast and back, as either should be, strive and thrive. Cry, speed, fight on, fare ever, there is here.
Anyhow, Christ's resurrection speaks to us not only of what he was, but what also the believer in him shall be in the life which is to come. Dr. Buttrick, George Arthur Buttrick, who lived from 1892 to 1980, told me when he was on campus, groaning with his arthritis,
"It isn't really arthritis what I got. It's Anno Domini. You don't have any cure for Anno Domini, do you?"
Do you know what he meant by that? Anno Domini means the year of our Lord. And he just meant he had old age. He said, "I've got Anno Domini. You don't have any cure for that, do you?" And I said, "Yes, the resurrection of the body." He wasn't used to that answer, and I think it's a good answer. And I think it's something that Christ is saying to all of us in the resurrection which he experienced. And that's all for this morning.
You've been listening to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lecture series are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity: Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevascrossing.com. Thank you for listening.